Hello, this is Black Country Blokes Chewing the Fat.
Listen.
I've been hearing a lot lately about men don't talk, but in my experience, men do talk, just people aren't listening. So it's going to be me and a group of blokes discussing our struggles and victories through life. Warning, there may be some bad language, so apologies to all the moms, especially my own. Let's get going.
Listen.
I've been the artist of Black Country Blokes chewing the fat about everything that is mental health, disability and life in general. Here with me, Kev Dillon, and my partner in crime, Lee Cadman. And today we're joined by Matt Smith. Now, Matt Smith has worked for TalkSport, has been to Football World Cups, Rugby World Cups, travelled the world, doing what most people listening here would think was the ideal job and life. But unfortunately, he has had problems with gambling, alcohol, as many people out there have. And now he is doing his great work for Bet No More. So, brother, thank you ever so much for coming on.
Kev Lee, good to be with you guys.
So, Matt, I mean, first, TalkSport. I mean, how did you manage to get into working for such a massive organisation?
Yeah, well, I mean, that was a long time ago now. I started there in 2001 and I went to university. I did a degree in broadcasting. Managed to get a job there, was really lucky. I worked behind the scenes doing the technical aspects, doing the kind of mixing desk and, all that kind of business. And I did that for a couple of years. And then I went on to producing programs and producing live sport from the studios. And then in 2005, so I've been there for 4 years, I got an opportunity to basically run all of the outside broadcasts for TalkSport. So I was their program manager. That was my title. And basically, I managed all the live events that we covered overseas. So in 2005, I went to Istanbul for that unbelievable Champions League final, if you remember it, Liverpool versus AC Milan. And that was like a baptism of fire for me because, that I was like 25 or something, you know what I mean? So I was doing this huge job at a young age where my, my colleagues at the BBC were probably, like in their 40s or early 50s doing that job. So, I was really thrown into it, which was great, that they had that trust in me. And then in 2006, I went on to do the World Cup finals in Germany. So I organized the tournament literally from scratch. So accommodation, travel, all the technical aspects, all the production aspects, making sure that people are where they need to be, when they need to be, and that they're on air on time. And a lot of work goes into that. I mean, that's a kind of building up to the process. It's a kind of a 1 year job. You start that process a year before arranging everything. So that's quite stressful as well. I pretty much did that job on my own as well. So it was stressful. And it wasn't just that. I was then doing football events, golf events at the same time. I then went to the Rugby World Cup in France in 2007. Then in 2008, we had the Euros in Switzerland, but England didn't qualify for that tournament. But I was there for a little while. And in 2010, we had South Africa, the World Cup. In 2011, I went to Rugby World Cup in New Zealand. And yeah, it was just great. What a job. I mean, you said at the beginning, I think, it was like a dream job, Like all my friends and all the people I went to school with in university were like, oh my word, this is what you're doing for a living. I mean, I never, if you'd have said to me, like when I was 15, this is what you were going to do for a living, I'd be like, nah, that's never going to happen. I always wanted to be a bit like what you guys are doing now. I was wanting to like present programs, but I never thought I was good enough to do that, so I ended up working behind the scenes. And I grew up in the Midlands, I grew up in Solihull, and I knew a few guys who worked at BRMB back in the day, and I used to hang around with them a little bit. I mean, if you guys remember Extra AM in the Midlands.
Yeah,
I used to know Paul Burrell quite well. Paul Burrell actually used to be the football stadium announcer as well at Arsenal. And I always used to say to Paul, I want to work in radio. How can I get in? And eventually I did. And made a really good career out of it. While I was there, we were really successful at TalkSport. We won a Sony Gold Award for Radio Station of the Year. We hit record audience figures. I mean, when I started there, our audience figures were, I think around 1.8 million. And I think when I left, we were about 3 million people. So I'm not saying that that was me, but I was part of that team who got us to that. And that South Africa World Cup was huge for us. It was the time where we really grew our audience. And we had like 23, 24 people in South Africa, and we were producing 18 hours a day of programs live from there, where, you know, the BBC would be there with like 60 people producing, you know, half the amount of time every day. So we worked hard, and it was a good job. And I loved my colleagues as well, you know, my colleagues that I worked with, and I still keep in touch with some of them now. Some of them have been really supportive of my journey, which has been brilliant. And they're still going to be supportive in the future, which is nice too. And yeah, we've kind of gone full circle now, but yeah, it was a great job.
But did you start gambling during that period?
Yeah, I did, Lee. Yeah. So basically, when I was at university, I used to like gamble on fruit machines. And you know, like as a student, you want a bit of extra money in your pocket. It's hard being a student. Do you know what I mean? It's like you're up to your eyeballs in debt with student loans. You want to enjoy yourself a little bit, because for me it wasn't really about the education side of things. For me it was like the life experience of going to university, living with other people and learning how to live, like be self-sufficient in a way, you know. I think that's forgotten a bit now when we talk about university. It's not just about the education, it's about the life skills that you learn. And so, but you want to feel part of. And to feel part of, you need to have a bit of money in your pocket to go out and have a few drinks and party and enjoy yourself and all that stuff. So I was like, yeah, I'd gamble on fruit machines, not to the point that caused me huge problems, but, you know, I'd have to ring my mum now and again and say, oh, I've run out of money, you know, it's hard times, blah, 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 can you send me some money, you know?
And by the way, it's normally that in them hard times where you're trying to turn your last £2 into £20.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. Yeah. And because in your head, you'd think, you know what, if I turn that £2 into £20, that's another night out or another couple of nights out. Do you know what I mean? That's how my head used to work with it. So I gambled there. And then when I left, I stopped gambling when I got my new job at TalkSport. I didn't gamble for like 8 or 9 years, I think. It was like 2010. We were in South Africa at the World Cup. That's when it started to take off for me again. I was quite stressed out at that tournament. Like I had a lot of work on my plate, moving people around a country where you've also got to think of security issues as well. You know, you're thinking about the safety and the health and well-being of your colleagues. Some colleagues can be difficult to work with as well. You know, you're working with
I know that all too well.
How rude.
Yeah. you know, you're working with ex-professional sports people who can be difficult at times. You know, some of them, by the way, are absolutely fantastic. You know, people like Alvin Martin, who I worked with, you know, Alvin played for West Ham and England. It was brilliant. You know, what a great guy to work with. But some are more difficult, and that would cause you a lot of stress and anxiety at times, because you wanted it to work out right. And we were staying in a place called Sandton in Johannesburg. We had this like guest lodge there for us all to stay in for a while. And we had a casino around the corner from us. And I said to the lads one night, oh, I think it was before the tournament started, so we weren't really at full tilt. I said, oh, let's head down to the casino. So a few of us all went down there. Before I know it, I'm on the blackjack tables, and I'm doing quite a bit of money. I mean, I don't like to talk about amounts of money, Lee and Kev, because it's not really relevant. It's when I say it's not relevant, I mean it's what it does to your mental health, not about the money that you lose. Do you know what I mean? You could bet £1 or £1,000; it still has the same effect on you as a compulsive problem gambler. So we were sat at this table, and before I know it, it's like 5 o'clock in the morning, and I'd lost, you know, quite a lot of money. And I think that what it was, because I felt like the pressure of the event and everything. I mean, I'd been to South Africa twice before I actually even got there for the tournament itself. I'd been there to do recces and all that kind of stuff. And I was absolutely fine. I had no problem then. And yeah, I was just like gambling, and then I'd get back to the place we were staying, and I started to gamble online as well then. So it literally went from no gambling to being in a casino to gambling online.
Do you think like from the student gambling was chasing the money to stay out, whereas the other one's got the money but chasing the buzz?
Yeah, I think so. What you're right there, because typically with a gambler or somebody who has issues with alcohol or drugs, you're chasing that first buzz, you're chasing that first win, but you can never replicate that first win.
Yeah,
you can't replicate that feeling that you had the first time that you did it. But what happens then is you start to get into this vicious circle. Now, I was, you know, quite well paid in the job that I did. You know, I was lucky. I was very fortunate. But that money goes pretty quickly when you're gambling online, because you don't see it as physical cash either. You just see it as numbers on the screen, you know, which can go really, really, really quick. I mean, I'm talking, you can blow your whole salary in the space of 25 minutes, you know, easily. And not even think about the consequences. How are you going to pay your rent? How are you going to pay your bills? How are you going to get to work every day and all those things? That doesn't even come into your head. You're going to make it back.
You're going to stay there until you make it back. And before you know it, it's all gone. Then you're chasing.
Yeah, all you think to yourself is, oh, one more go and I'll win it back. Mm. And you might do. You might win back 20 times what you put in, but it's going back in again. Mm. Typically, as a gambler, I never used to tell people about my losses, but I'd always tell them about my wins. Do you know what I mean? That's what you do. And you'd go out with your mates with a bundle of cash and, oh, I've got this tonight, lads. You know what I mean? And the reason you do that is because you think, you know what, if I look after them now, they might look after me if I need a bit of help later down the line. So, yeah, just going back to South Africa. So I was in this vicious circle of just like gambling online, not every day, because I had a lot of work to do as well. And I wasn't really full on in it at that time, and I had access to money. So even though I'd done my salary while I was there, I did have access, like I had people I could borrow off and stuff like that at that point, because I hadn't been gambling, I hadn't been caught out, nothing had gone wrong for me at that point. And it carried on. I mean, it went on. I got back from South Africa and I just kept going, guys. Do you know what I mean? I kept going for another year, and I then went to New Zealand to the Rugby World Cup. And that is where I think it really started to get pretty bad for me. Now, I was with my colleague, Mark Saggers, and Mark hosts the Bet No More podcast as well, where we talk about gambling harms. And I used to work with Mark at TalkSport. And Mark is in recovery for gambling as well. And I know he'll be okay with me saying that, because he obviously has said it himself into the wider world. And Mark said to me in a restaurant one day, he started talking to me about gambling. So this was in 2011 in Auckland, in New Zealand. We were working. He started talking to me about gambling. He could see it in me. He could see what I was doing, because he'd been there himself. He'd walked in those shoes. And he started to have this conversation. And guys, it went woof, straight over my head, because like I wasn't ready to listen to what he was telling me. Now, wind the clock forward 10 years, and a few months ago, I seen Mark again, and Mark said, do you remember that conversation we had in that restaurant? And I said, yeah, I do remember that. And he planted the seed at that point with me. And he didn't tell me at that point that he'd had a problem with gambling, that he was in recovery. But what he did was plant that seed, and it made me start to think. But I couldn't stop. I was still gambling my brains out. I was there a long time. That was a long tournament. I think I was there for like 8 weeks in the end or something. It's a long time to be away from home, away from your friends, away from family. But, you know, that was my job. So I'm not saying like that it was the job's fault. It wasn't. I knew what I was doing. That was the job, and that's what it is. You know, that's part of it.
Did you gamble on the games as well, or because of the work you were in, you couldn't do that?
No, you know what? I never did, strangely enough. Like people always say, and I was never really a footballer. I never used to bet on football. I never used to bet on like rugby or any sport. I was more casino or online, or I'd do a bit of horse racing. That's it.
So the reason I ask you is because you've kind of most obviously set up for that, because I presume within your work as well, you've got kind of the inside track. So maybe
Our
player's got a niggle, or this has happened, so you're more chance of going that way.
Yeah,
but I suppose it's what you get, what you get addicted to, isn't it? There's different forms of gambling, like there's different forms of alcohol you can get addicted to.
Yeah, that's right. And also, typically, I think with a gambler, you think you know better.
Yeah. That's from addiction overall, isn't it? You're always the smartest man in the room.
Yeah, of course you are. So, like, people might tell me, these tips, you know, and then you just like complete. I remember one guy who was very well connected in the horse racing world, and he said to me, this horse, and I thought, well, you've never, all the time I've known you, you've never given me a winner, so I'm not bothering. I told everybody else in the box we were in at the race course about this tip, and it absolutely romped home at like 25-1, you know. But that was, again, my like delusional thinking was, oh, no, I know better than it. He was seriously well connected, by the way. So he knew what was what. But I still couldn't, you know, I couldn't believe it. I was like, no, no. So, yeah, so really, I didn't do the sports events. But what I would say is I was at a lot of sports events. And, you know, we talk about horse racing. I went to Cheltenham every year for about 7 or 8 years. And I led the production of the Alan Brazil breakfast show from Cheltenham every year, which, you know, always used to be a lot of fun, and whether Alan was going to turn up in the morning or not. And I look back at it now and I laugh about it. But at the time, it's quite stressful because you've got your main presenter every day and wondering, actually, is he going to be here or not? Do you know what I mean? And, you know, the crazy thing is, a lot of the time I wouldn't actually stay at Cheltenham for the racing. So I had a pass. I could stay all day. I was often invited to boxes and to meet people and have a drink. I didn't do that. I drove to a bookmaker's because I didn't want to be around anybody. I wanted to hide my gambling away. I wanted to hide away. I didn't even want to bet on Cheltenham. I'd be like betting on other racing going on, not even bothering. While the world's going crazy about Cheltenham, I'm like, no, I'm not interested in Cheltenham. And all I'm interested in is this.
I think with addiction, that is as well, isn't it? And I think it's different nowadays that we don't all go to the pub as much as we used to, because that's where we used to go. You go to the off license and you go to the pub.
Yeah.
But now it's so easy to drink on your own.
Yeah.
And back in the day, when you'd had enough, the landlord or a barmaid or one of your mates would go, "Deal, Kev, you know, you've had enough. On yep. your way now." But when you're just stumbling from your settee to the fridge, and before you know it, you're drinking little miniatures. Remember, you used to get the miniatures?
You get in the hotel.
Don't get them anymore.
Yeah.
But when you're hiding your addiction from whoever,
yeah,
that's when it is the problem, isn't it? So it's not me and you, or me and you are sat here now, go a tenner on Jasper. But when you're hiding it from there, and it's on your phone, it's on a... When you were at university, a slot machine was a pound machine. Now yeah. you can sit there and literally put £50 on the spinners, and it's amazing how fast it can go, isn't it?
Oh, look, it goes in no time at all. And, you know, the crazy thing is I know so many people who were addicted to... I mean, fruit machines wasn't really my thing. It was when I was at university, but that was it. I never used to bother with them after that because... I had these delusions of grandeur that I was like a high roller, you know what I mean? I wasn't messing around on fruit machines. I'd be on the big tables, you know. And the funny thing is, the people that I speak to about that, say if the jackpot on one of those machines was, let's just say, for example, it was £500, yeah? Mm. They would put three times that amount in just to win that £500 because their brain is like, I've got to win that 500. I don't care how much I put in. I just want to get that 500 out. And then when they get it out, they stick it all back in again anyway.
You know, I ran pubs for quite a few years, and there was professional gamblers then who would come round just for the machines, and you'd just see them piling these in. Or if someone else was using a machine over there, you'd see it like a hawk watching them. They literally went round individual pubs just to watch, see what was going on with the machine, or pile their money into it. And I've never understood it myself, to be quite honest, because I've bet probably a handful of times at the most in my life, and it's usually on boxing. I usually get it wrong, and I've always considered I know a lot about boxing, so, you know, it's put me off straight away. But, yeah, I saw it for years of people putting money in it, and you're right, they do. It could be a £500 limit, but you can guarantee they put £1,000 in it to try and get £500.
Yeah, that's right. And when you ran pubs, Lee, would you think, like, say if somebody had had a few too many to drink, would you think, like, put an arm around them and say, look, you know, come on, let's wrap it up for the night now? Or would you just leave it? Or how, like, was it a bit more old school then and you could do that, do you think, or no?
I think it depended on the person and the situation, to be totally honest, because there's some some people, you would let them drink themselves into oblivion. Let's be honest. You know, you're there to make money. As horrible as that now is to me. But yeah. Other people, you could see they were getting, they might be getting agitated. They might be getting emotional. So you kind of go, actually, you have had enough. You know, it really depended on the person at the time. But looking back now, from my perspective, there's a lot of people I should have stopped drinking before that point, because they did have issues, you know. But even with the drinking thing, now there's a lot of people who used to, they might necessarily have got drunk, but they were in that pub every day and they'd drink 5 pints. Now, to me, now looking at it now, that's excess.
Yeah.
You know, that's definitely too much and shouldn't happen. But you're in a tricky situation as a pub landlord still now.
My friend used to have a pub, sorry, and they said, like, and we'll all relate to this, and you go, like, oh, you know, Kev is in here every night. He's in here every night. And I'll tell you something, Kev is the best bloke. He has 8 points. I'll tell you something, his missus writes sour cow. She phones him every night going, where's Kev? But you're thinking, he's out every night drinking 8 points while his wife's at home going, come home, our kids are here. Yeah. But you see Kev's being a laugh and the wife is being a sour cow, whereas really, yeah, he should be at home with his business. She wouldn't be so miserable.
The wife's right.
Yeah. But it's funny whose side we take, because we've never met her. Yeah. And Kev's always saying, what a misery guts.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's true. And, you know, I was going to say, like what Lee was saying, and then it must be really difficult for landlords to, like, behave. Like, we talk about it a bit, like we've bookmakers now doing more around safer gambling, so that the staff in the shops are, you know, are typically trained in spotting signs of problem gambling and start to have conversations with the people that work in the shops. Who are betting in the shops, if they can see that that person is perhaps, you know, betting too much, or is betting in an unusual manner that they don't usually bet, which might mean that they're starting to have a problem, or they've got a problem, that they're kind of almost like an intervention. But it's really difficult, because when you have that conversation, A, somebody like me is going to lie to you and say, actually, you know what, I'm okay with this. I mean, I remember being in a casino in London once, and if you bet, I think if you bought chips on your card 3 times, the casino manager would have to come over and speak to you, and he asked me, can you afford to do this? Well, I'm not going to say no, am I? Because, you know, I lose face then, so I'm going to say, yeah, of course I can, and he goes away. But that's it. That was all the conversation was. You know, it wasn't any more. It was just, yes, I can, and that was it. Okay, fine, bye. You know, but I think now that they're trying to do, you know, more around that. And we at Bet No More, you know, part of Bet No More, what we do, we've got BKM Evolve, which is, you know, the business side of what we do. And they're working with the industry and helping them to devise safer gambling programs and to train the staff to spot signs. And that's, you know, whether that's land-based or online as well. So, because what we can do, you see, is that, as a charity, is that we have access to people like myself with lived experience. There's quite a few of us who have lived experience. So we can offer that to the industry and say, look, you know, these are the things to look out for. But I can, putting myself in the shoes of somebody who works in a betting shop, it must be really difficult to start having that conversation. You've got to build that relationship up over time before, like you said, Lee, before you might feel comfortable with the customer that's coming who's had a few too many to drink.
Yeah, and I do wonder whether it's kind of the right way of going about it, because ultimately the person who is, for want of a better word, confronting that person about their gambling issue works for the company who's probably putting stress on them to put more money in the tills. It's a very difficult position to be in.
And you don't want conflict.
Well, you shouldn't be thinking about the money at that point, definitely not. But ultimately, that doesn't matter to the people who are above you. They want to know what money's gone into the till. They don't really want it. They're not, this is my experience, they're not overly interested in whether that person's turned into an alcoholic to get that money. And I can imagine it's kind of the same with the gambling. I suppose the one key difference with alcohol is, if I was to carry on serving someone who was really highly intoxicated, potentially if police did come in, I could have got in a lot of trouble for carrying on serving. And whereas that, they don't, there's not that safety barrier within gambling, is there? Because you can't prove it ultimately.
No, that is the difference with alcohol and drugs. You can see it in somebody and you can hear it in somebody, But the signs of somebody gambling are really different. Ultimately, what ends up happening is there is really serious behavior changes with those individuals. So it's like any addiction, you know, where somebody's behavior really changes from that person that you once knew. They're not going to be that person anymore. You know, they're probably going to be very manipulative, deceitful, and all of those types of things. And they're going to be very selfish. But that's probably not who they really are. Those are all the masks while they're gambling. You know, once they stop gambling, the mask can come off again and they'll be that person. But you know, it's very, very difficult to spot. But we are trying to help people, you know, to see the signs so that they have got, you know, a bit of a head start.
I think addiction, no matter what it is, with drugs, alcohol, sex, gambling, it takes away the person, because all you're thinking about is your next fix, aren't you?
Yeah, I mean, that's all you're thinking about. And when you're gambling, your next fix, you need to obtain money. And, you know, you're going to friends, you're going to family, you're making up things. I mean, the amount of stories I'd make up to my friends and family to get money, to borrow money, were just crazy. I mean, you know, your car's breaking down every week. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And that's the lie that you're telling constantly. And, you know, we spoke before we came on about how many people a gambler affects. And, you know, if one person's gambling, they're probably affecting 15 to 20 people, if not more, at a time. So we're getting to the stage where you look at it like that and we think, well, we're in an epidemic, you know. I was recently on holiday, as I was telling you guys, and I went out on a nature walk one day, and it was absolutely beautiful. But a couple of ladies on the walk were from England, and they started talking to me, and they asked me what I did for a living, and I told them. And they're both doctors, GPs, and they said to me, gambling is a disease. And, you know, they recognise it. You know, they recognise that.
See, for me, Matt, I'm not sure how I personally believe that about addiction being a disease. I understand it's a mental illness, but would I go as far to saying it was a disease? In my opinion, I'm not sure. How would you perceive it?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of agree with you in a way, Kev, because I don't really see it as a disease myself. I do see it as a serious mental health problem. I recognize it as a public health issue because I believe that it's a public health issue. A disease is typically something that we probably see as more of a kind of physical affliction, don't we, rather than something mental. Of course, you know, there's lots of different things that affect lots of different people. But, yeah, I'm not too sure. I mean, it's typically when you speak to people who are in recovery for alcohol and drugs, they talk about disease as dis-ease. So people who are at dis-ease, you know, they're not at ease with themselves. They're not comfortable with themselves. That was me, by the way.
And I can agree with that.
Yeah, that's how they describe it. So they kind of change the word disease to dis-ease a little bit. So, I mean, I completely get that because, you know, when I worked at football matches, I mean, I must have gone to like 300 or 400 football matches in my working life. I felt incredibly lonely a lot of the time. Now, I'd be sat there and the place that always springs to mind is Old Trafford, yeah? I used to go to Old Trafford quite a lot, and it was really the press box there where the media sits, really tight. It's like really like you're crammed in like these there, not like Manchester City where you've got like acres of space, you know, they look after you, but it was really tight there. And so you used to be sat really close to your colleagues, to each other. So typically when I was working there, I'd have the presenter one side of me and the commentators the other side of me, and I'd sit in the middle of them both like that, with 60,000-70,000 people in the stadium, and I'm completely in my own head, feeling lonely, feeling I've got nothing, feeling empty. And that is so difficult to, because you're trying to work at the same time. You're trying to talk to your colleagues, but it's not really it's not really going in. Do you know what I mean? Because all you're thinking about is how you feel. And I've heard that a lot from people, you know, because I do believe that loneliness and mental health is seriously linked together. Mm-hmm. And I believe that also loneliness is a state of mind. Mm-hmm. That you can get out of that state of mind, but you have to connect. I mean, the opposite to addiction is connection.
Mm. And I always said on this show, saying the best friend of any mental health is loneliness. But yet the opposite of it is connection, where it's connecting to something or someone. And we're always brave when we've got someone to hold our hand or to get through it together, aren't we?
Oh, yeah. I mean, my colleague, John Norman, and you won't mind me mentioning him. I worked with him at TalkSport. He's TalkSport's cricket editor still now. He stuck with me on my journey. So I left TalkSport in 2012. I was working at the Euros in Poland and Ukraine, and everything was getting on top for me. Like, I had debt coming out my ears. I owed money left, right and centre. People were chasing me down. It was just dreadful. Do you know what I mean? It was a dreadful situation for my colleagues as well, you know, more than anybody, really, not for myself, because I came out the other end, but I affected them really badly. And I came back to the UK and I ended up going to counselling, to therapy, which TalkSport sent me to. You know, they knew all about the problem at this time. It all came out, was all exposed. We talked through it. The plan was for me to go back to work, but I had to deal with my issues. So the plan was I'd go and stay out in the countryside. I went and stayed with Ronnie Irani, former England and Essex cricketer. I went and stayed with Ronnie. God bless Ronnie. You know, he looked after me, him and his family. But the bottom line is, as a gambler, unless you're ready, like Lee, you were saying earlier about stopping some of them people from drinking, but you couldn't have helped them. They have to want to help themselves. And this was it for me. Like, everybody was telling me, Matt, you can come back to work if you do this. Mm-hmm. Ronnie was saying to me, Matt, if you gamble in this house, you're out. Do you know what I mean? It's as simple as that. These are the house rules. That don't stop you when you're gambling. You don't think of the consequences. So ultimately, I left, you know, about 6 months later. You know, there was no way back for me because I couldn't stop gambling. But I had gone to Gamblers Anonymous meetings during that period, but I wasn't really into it. I wasn't ready to stop. Mm-hmm. But my friend John stuck with me, and he would text me now and again just to say, how are you doing? You know, he knew all the stuff that had gone on. But still, he said to me, and he says it to me now to this day, he says, you're never a bad person. You weren't a bad person. You're not a bad person. You were just doing bad things. Because that's what the addiction was taking you to. I knew you. You know, he's like a brother to me. Do you know what I mean?
Sorry, can I just cut it? I think we forget that about every addiction, don't we? That there's ultimately there's a person behind that addiction, and they're not bad people. They've just gone through different experiences, and they're trying to make their way through life with an addiction. And I think that there needs a lot more empathy in helping those people, especially when they're asking for help.
You're spot on, Lee. You know, the thing is, like I say to people, when I read on social media and people are having a dig at somebody for drinking too much or this, you know, this, that and the other, I say, that could be your mum, your dad, your brother, your sister. You know, you're looking down on homeless people in the street. You're talking, you know, you've got no empathy whatsoever. What if that was a member of your family? What if that was one of your friends? You might think a little bit differently then. Do you know what I mean? That's where... Like, my life's changed as well now, in the sense that I think at times in my life I was judgmental. And now I would never dream of, like, behaving in that way because I've been there. I've walked in those shoes. I was nearly homeless. I mean, I was literally one day away from being homeless. We'll get onto that in a little while. But, you know, there was, yeah, you know, there needs to be more empathy. There needs to be more kindness. There needs to be more compassion. I read, like, online recently, somebody lives in my... you know, local town, they said about the homeless person who sleeps outside the coffee shop every night, you know, like, what are they doing there type thing. And I thought, well, why don't you go over the road, get off your backside and go and have a conversation with them? Stop posting it on social media. Go and have a conversation. There's a fella I know in Christchurch near where I live. He sits by the supermarket there every day. He's homeless, but he doesn't want money. He just wants a conversation.
He just wants to torture you.
I think that comes to that loneliness again, doesn't it? He probably sees thousands of people a day outside the supermarket, but how many people stop and just have a chat?
Yeah. How many people stop? Because why don't they stop, Lee? Do you know why? In my mind, they don't stop because they're fearful. They're scared. That's why. Because when somebody's homeless, for some reason, they become scary. Why is society... What's gone wrong here? Why do we think because somebody lives on the street that they're frightening, that they scare you? Because perhaps, if they live on the street, that must mean that they rob people because they can't live any other way. They must rob people. We all know that's not true. And we treat people in that way, which I just don't understand it. I really can't get my head around why we look at people like that.
But even like your charity shops, we go and give the clothes, the hats, the socks for free. But then they'll see a man or a woman sitting outside in the wet. Your natural thing would go, we've had it for nothing. Go and help yourself something. But if they're going to go and sell it, well, then they've got a bit of money to buy themselves a coffee. Yeah. It's there to be a charity, to give back to the people.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's what charities are ultimately there for. Charities are to help and support people. So, yeah, it goes back to my thinking that, you know, we're not bad people. People who have been addicts, who are in recovery, who are homeless, whatever. You know, like people get down on their luck sometimes. You know, and we've got to help people just a leg up now and again.
And as I think Lee said, and you alluded to, and if people are knocking the door, then answer it and say, like, let's get you to rehab, let's get you to whatever it is. And I think instead of locking people up and throwing away the key and let's try and make people better. But we have got a way for them to knock on the door. Otherwise, you know, they'll never walk through it.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that what we do now with Bet No More, one of our main programs that we do that on the charity side is what we call Peer Aid. And Peer Aid is basically a service that has been set up, which has people who have lived experience of gambling, who then support people who are trying to get into recovery. So they're referred into us by GamCare. They have a practitioner at GamCare. So they do the clinical stuff on that side. And then they're offered, somebody who we call a peer supporter who is in recovery from gambling, who can empathize and be non-judgmental and understand the path they're on. So the two work side by side. And it's absolutely, I mean, it's a little bit like Gamblers Anonymous. You know, I mean, I attend Gamblers Anonymous meetings now every week. And you have what we call a sponsor-sponsee relationship in Gamblers Anonymous, where somebody who has that lived experience may support somebody who hasn't. But we're doing it, that's done in a kind of non-structured setting. What we're doing is it's a structured setting, which is very safe. And, you know, we have a lot of support structure in place around that. So we're very different in that sense. But the feedback we get off people is unbelievable. And we've now got people in the service who have come through it themselves as somebody who had a problem with gambling. They're now got to over a year in recovery and they're now training to be a peer supporter themselves and help the next lot come through. And three of those people have now gone on to have paid employment with Bet No More. So you can see that organic process.
For me, I've said this a million times, for me personally, the amount that doing this podcast has helped my own mental health. And we often say that we're not qualified, but we're experienced.
Yes.
But one of the fascinating things with me also is talking to people like yourself, people who have had that lived experience, who've been through it. No, I've not been through gambling addiction, but I understand a lot more of it now by talking to people like yourself. We've had plenty of guests on who have really not known a great deal at all about what they're going through, but by talking to them and them explaining, it's been great. But you cannot beat someone who's been through a similar experience to you, for me to help you get through that experience. I think it's fantastic.
You're right, Lee. I mean, the amount of people that I say to, you know, if you want to work in this sector, I mean, I didn't know what I wanted to do for a long time. You know, I left TalkSport. I went and worked in Singapore for a while, which is just crazy because I was still gambling my head off over there in a foreign country. That's frightening. Do you know what I mean? Because you've just got you've got nobody around you. You don't know anybody. I mean, that was scary stuff, you know. And I didn't know. I went into I went into rehab, and I'll come to that in a second, but I didn't know what I wanted to do. And eventually it came to me, like you just described, I've got lived experience. Doesn't matter, I've got a university degree, actually. You know what? I've got lived experience in gambling. I want to help people now, you know, in any way I can. But actually, I've got quite a good professional background as well. So I'm sure, you know, I can get into somewhere. I can give a lot. Do you know what I mean? Because, you know, charities want people from lots of different sectors because they've got experience, you know. So you're typically, when you work for a charity, you're working with people who've come from all different walks of life who've then ended up coming together to then support and help people. So lived experience for me is absolutely invaluable for somebody to say, you know what, Matt, I've been where you've been. I've done that. I've had people sat in my flat here, you know, who have struggled with gambling. And I've said, look, I'm not going to judge you in any way, shape or form, because you know what you're about to tell me, I've already done.
And I think with addiction, like abuse, is an equalizer. It can happen to anyone at any time with any, you know what I mean? It isn't, you tick this box, therefore this has happened to you. It happens in wealthy neighborhoods, in poor neighborhoods, in multicultural, in straight, in gay. It can happen anywhere to anyone, can't it?
Yeah, you know what, Kev? As soon as you said that, I was like, wow, yeah, that's it. 100% that is it. Because somebody's situation can also change at any time.
Yes.
Their vulnerability can change from hour to hour. Mm. I mean, if suddenly you as an individual have an emotional distress in your life, that emotional distress could then be the trigger for you to start drinking or gambling or doing something, you know, off key, because you, that might become suddenly your coping mechanism to deal with that. What I've learned, and I'm sure you guys have learned with your experience, is actually the key to dealing with those situations is talking about it. Which, wow, how powerful is that, by the way? You know what I mean?
So we've got a question coming from Andrew Manini on LinkedIn. So
Andrew, good guy, yeah. Yeah.
So he asked, what support is offered by the government and NHS to help reduce the issues that addiction to gambling is bringing to our society?
Well, I mean, the government, well, good question what the government are doing. There is the Gambling Act review at the moment, which I think we're going to see more on later this year. And we're going to see some changes with the industry. And we're hoping that those changes are going to be good changes, that they're going to help people more. The industry do put money into a pot to help services run. That is a contentious issue at times. But at the end of the day, you know, you need money to run services. So I know the NHS are now moving away from that funding model. They do have the NHS gambling clinics. You know, anybody who has got an issue with gambling or they've got a friend or a family member, they can have a look on our website, you know, betnomoreuk.org, and you can see phone numbers there for the National Gambling Treatment Service, for GamCare. There are services out there as well for friends and family. So there is a lot of support out there now. It's growing. You know, the stuff I just mentioned about peer aid, you can see about peer aid on our website and on our Twitter. On our Twitter is aid peer for to look about what peer aid does. We've got all sorts of services going on at the moment. We've got the late on International Women's Day, I should mention, you know, big up to the women that work for us at Bet No More. We've got a few of them, and that what they do is fantastic. And they're now working really hard to launch a women's service, because women typically can find it difficult to get into recovery because it is quite a male dominated area. So we're now creating services to help women. You know, it's all go. I mean, it really is. I mean, I've only been at Bet No More for over a year, and I've seen it double in size in that time.
You know, I think's mad. Sorry to interrupt, mate. But you know, like saying about women, and this isn't a sexist thing, by the way. But like my nan used to love the bingo, but she used to go to a bingo hall.
Yeah.
But now she was still alive, I guarantee she'd have been on a computer doing a bingo on there. But then you don't see your pounds going in because you haven't got a good purse to go and buy another card. And before you know it, you might spend a tenner, then it's £100. And what I always think, because I'm not from it, I don't have a flutter, but I see like celebrity in the jungle, bingo, or Coronation Street, bingo. And I'm thinking, that's just a way to lure you into gambling. It's like the Alka-Pop of gambling.
Yeah. Well, you know, we've seen a lot of gambling advertising on the TV. Now, they've stopped during the football. They used to have the live stuff going on. They're not allowed to now advertise at certain times during matches and stuff like that. I think there is going to be some bigger changes because, do you know, like you guys were talking about the boxing earlier was sponsored by alcohol, you know, the snooker. Do you remember the snooker and the Formula
Benson
One?
Benson and Helly. Jesus.
Benson and Helly's Budweiser.
And I think that gambling is going to have that kind of that moment soon, that watershed moment, you know, where we're going to actually, you know, have to see changes. You've got a lot of I follow a lot of like on Facebook and stuff. I'm an Aston Villa fan, by the way. I don't know if I should tell you guys that.
We know nothing about football. You're absolutely safe.
In your neck of the woods, I don't know what I should say and what I shouldn't say. You know what I mean? But, you know, I see a lot of times on those Facebook groups, people saying, you know, I don't like when Aston Villa's associated with a gambling company. You know, I mean, we're lucky we haven't got it on our shirt at the moment. We're not a club that's got it on a shirt, but we're involved with certain things which, you know, as a club, you think, well, you know, come on, you can do better than that. You don't need. So I think there will be some bigger changes in the future around advertising. And also, you know, you were talking then about bingo and that, Kevin, like your nan liking the bingo and that, because that's a social thing as well, remember. And by the way, I've got to say this about gambling. There's people who can gamble completely normally.
People drinking, like with everything else.
Yeah, there's people who can go to a bookies on a Saturday afternoon, have a couple of hours there with their pals, and then walk out. And that's great, and that's fine. But we've got to protect the people who are vulnerable as well. Do you know what I mean? We've got to help both sides here. And I think, you know, we are going to see more and more changes.
But could I ask about two things? First thing was that when you said you almost lost your house through gambling.
Yeah. So, well, I didn't, I nearly ended up homeless. So when I lived in London, I had a nice place I lived in. I didn't own my house, but I know many gamblers who did own their houses and lose their houses. And lost their families as well, and lots of other things. And that's just, I'm not saying that for effect. It's the truth, by the way. This is what happens. People lose jobs, people lose families, people lose everything.
Their life.
You
know, every people we've met over the years who've completed suicide because the fear of losing everything, losing the family, losing. And it was, oh my God, my partner's going to find out, or oh my God, the bailiffs are coming to take it away. And then they've gone and taken their lives over it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I know people who have had suicidal ideation during their time gambling. I know somebody who was part of my group who we lost from gambling. Now, he was a long time in recovery for drugs and alcohol. I mean, I'm telling you, like 20 years, but he was gambling his brains out and he committed suicide. And he was coming to our group regularly. And he, the amount of people that he helped was unbelievable, you know, and supported, but he was fighting a raging battle in his head. So my story, so I left my job at TalkSport. I then went and worked overseas, and then I went and worked in Brazil at the 2014 World Cup. And my gambling really at that point was like at its peak. Now, I was on a real good job, a real good earner of a job, and I thought, in my head, like, oh, this will keep me going for 6 months when I get back. This is enough to keep me going for 6 months. Well, I hadn't taken into account that I'm gambling every day, so it's not going to keep me going for 6 months, is it? Do you know what I mean? And I came back to the UK, and I literally, at that point, I'd not spoken to my mum for over a year because I was so ashamed. I felt so guilty. Now, she lives on her own. So the effect that that was having on her, the worry, the stress, I mean, she had to go to therapy. She told me she went to therapy because she, like,
her only child, you know, has just disappeared off the face of the earth. So we've got a great relationship now, by the way, the best we've ever had. So, you know, that's the good side to it. And, you know, we get on great. She lives near me now as well. She just moved down near me recently and we get on fantastic. But I still regret that, you know, to this day, I can't get over that. You know, even though she doesn't hold that against me, she never brings it up. In my head, I still can't quite get over it.
Me as a parent, I can't even fathom that, to be honest. Not to hear off any of my kids. They're young now, but when they're old, not to hear off them for over a year would just, you know, you can't even think that, can you, Kev?
But you're lost in shame, aren't you?
I understand why you didn't do it, but my God, the worry she must have gone through in the...
She was worried sick. She was like, you know, and I was abroad and the police are involved and, you know, you're a missing person effectively. But you're so guilty and you feel so ashamed. And the longer you leave it, the more difficult it is. Now, when I say I didn't talk to her, I did contact her now and again. I'd write her a letter or a card. So she knew I was alive from time to time, but she didn't know where I was. Mm. Anyway, so I came back from Brazil and I had nowhere to go. I had a bag of clothes, yeah? Had nowhere to go. I'd done all my money. All the money that I'd earned that time there, which I've just said was going to last me about 6 months, I'd done the lot online. And I had nowhere to go, and I contacted somebody who I hadn't spoken to for many years and said, oh, can I come and stay with you for a night? I'm trying to sort myself out. Yeah, you can come. So I went there for a night, which ended up turning into about 4 weeks. Which was a dreadful place for me to go as well. Although it was an old acquaintance of mine, there was a lot of using drugs in there. There was a lot of drinking going on in there. I was sleeping on a camp bed on the floor. I've gone from this great job in London, in a nice flat, living a decent life, to the bottom of the barrel. Do you know what I mean? Literally, that's how I felt. And during the period when I went to counselling, I met a guy called Paul Spanger, and Paul Spanger runs the Providence Project in Bournemouth, which is a rehab centre. And Paul came up to London to meet me because he knew Ronnie Irani, and they'd done some work with Paul Gascoigne in the past. And because I worked at Talk Sport, a lot of things were all connected there. And Paul came and met me, Paul Spanger, and he talked to me about addiction and this, that and the other, and you know, he tried to get me on the right path. So what happened then, fast forward 2 years, I contacted Paul. I woke up one morning on this camp bed feeling absolutely destitute, had no money, I hadn't showered for days, I was just off it basically. My mental health was really suffering. I was so anxious, I was waking up full of anxiety every morning. I don't know if you guys have experienced anxiety, but that kind of shaking nervousness, you know, as soon as you wake up every day. Do you know what I mean? That, like, it's just a horrible, horrible feeling that you're on edge constantly. And I woke up that morning and thought, I don't want to live like this anymore. I've just had enough. And I contacted Paul and I said, Paul, I don't know if you remember me. And he said, yes, I do. And I said, I need help. He said, come to Bournemouth. My friend John, who I mentioned earlier, I emailed him and I said, John, I'm going to rehab. I'm going to treatment. Now, I told so many lies and manipulated so much. I'd asked him to buy me a train ticket. I said, please, I need the train ticket to go. I had no other means of going. Do you know what I mean? I had to get from Birmingham down to Bournemouth. And he didn't get in touch with me all that day, and eventually he got in touch with me and he said, I bought you the train ticket, but I need you to know I had to phone them first to check you were going. That's what it had come to. Do you know what I mean? That's what it had come to. Like, he wasn't there to finance my life running around the country, was he? You know, and he said that to me, and I'm sure I said something along the lines of, yeah, but you've booked me the train ticket at 11 o'clock in the morning. I don't want to go that time. I'm sure something crazy like that, you know, because that's how my head worked. You know what I mean? Like, it all had to be on my terms.
Yeah.
And that was it. That I got on the train. I'm here now, still in Bournemouth, 7.5 years later. Providence Project was the best thing that ever happened to me, you know. And I went to treatment for 6 months.
Can I ask two questions about that?
Yeah.
First question, did you have to fund it yourself, the rehab, or was it government led, or did you have to basically, is it free or is it private?
So it's private, but for me, I was very, very lucky that they gave me a charitable place. I was very lucky indeed. And Paul gave me the place free.
But see, I believe that's got to change. That I've had friends on different drugs and loads of different things. And how expensive it is to get better. They'd rather lock you up and go put your Winston Green where they've got to look after, you know, fund you being there than to pay for you to get better.
Well, yeah, Kev, you're right. But a lot of funding has been stripped over the years. Now, where you are in Dudley, you've got Gordon Moody. And Gordon Moody is a rehab centre specifically for gambling. And I believe that is funded. So you can apply and go there and they will support you and help you. And they do some fantastic work. And I actually applied to go there, but I couldn't get there quick enough. This was the other thing. I might have had to wait 2 months to go there. I didn't have 2 months to wait. I literally, when I was said I wanted to go and Paul said, come now, that was it. If I would have waited a few more days and suddenly got my next kind of unemployment benefit or whatever, I'd have been back on gambling again. And I thought, nah, this is my life. This is the way I'm going to make all my money back and pay. You know what I mean? The delusion would have started again. So I had that one shot to go. Yeah. And you're right. There does need to be more funding. I was lucky enough to have a charitable, but they've been stripped of funding. You know, there used to be a lot of referral from alcohol and drug services. It's not there anymore. And particularly now, post-pandemic, there needs to be more because we're hearing about people. They talk regularly on the news, mental health, COVID, mental health. Yeah, but that mental health turns into addiction. Mm. So you need to fund those treatment centres.
But funny enough, I've been, ever since we were allowed to, I opened up the club in the daytime for free, 3 times a week for mixed classes, twice a week for women's classes. And is it to grown-ups? Because often grown-ups are forgotten about. We think about the children, and yes, there should be more youth clubs. But organisations, gyms, dojos, choirs, whatever it is, should be funded so people can go and do something. The old saying, the devil makes work of idle hands. But if you're around good people who are going to give you something to do, get you motivated, get you mentally fit, give you that community, as you said, connect with someone or something, you're less likely to use. And so if we can be funding these places, it hasn't got to be a detox centre, a therapist, but just somewhere positive for people to go, wouldn't that solve a lot of the problems?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I go to Gamblers Anonymous. Now, it's not for everybody, right? I understand that. I mean, to walk into a room of complete strangers and start to spill your entire life story is difficult. But remember, you can share as much or as little as you feel comfortable if you walk into one of those rooms. What I would say is, and we're very, very, very lucky in Bournemouth that we have a group that we're not just meeting to talk about gambling and our recoveries. We socialize together, we eat together, we go like most weeks after the meeting, we go for something to eat together, you know, 10, 15, 20 of us, you know, we connect. And also in those meetings, and also they're very similar to the health and wellbeing meetings that we run at Bet No More as part of Peer Aid, we're actually not talking about gambling because gambling. We're going to get onto something completely different now. I'd like to know what you guys think about this bit. Gambling is just a symptom of what's really going on. So the gambling is the outlet, yeah? But actually, what's really going on is all the things we've talked about, the mental health issues, the anxiety, the loneliness, all of those things are actually the real problem. The gambling was just the outlet.
I fully agree that with, as we say, sex addiction, drug addiction, that is the product that makes you feel better, makes you feel worthwhile, makes you feel justified, gives you that sense of whether you're in a drug clique, a gambling clique, a sex clique, that's your community of you are like me, so I am not odd. You are like me, so I'm not alone.
Yeah.
You are in this situation, so I haven't got to feel as bad because you are like me. Yeah. You are a reflection of myself and my personality and my outlet. Therefore, I am not alone.
Like-minded individuals.
Yeah, that's probably why it works so well in recovery as well, having people with lived experience around you. Because again, just like when you're in a drug addiction and you're around people, other people who take drugs or alcohol, where you're in a pub with loads of people who have alcohol, when you're in recovery and you're around people who are recovering, it's bound to rub off on you, isn't it? You kind of, with everything in life, if you're around a load of negative people, them negative thoughts soon overtake your own mind. If you're around loads of positive people and people who are building themselves up, naturally you do the same.
Well, we saw it in our support group because we work with Tough Enough to Care, and we're doing a support group, men's only support group, and it was great just having them like-minded souls, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And it was funny, you know, we'd have the conversation and it was, you'd sit there and you'd go, you too. And that was the, I always find it's about our public speaking and, oh, I have panic attacks and, oh, I feel like I'm going to have a dive. And people will go, you too. Or I had an, and it, by opening the door, people will walk through it. And that's what these talks hopefully do. Hopefully there's people out there now listening going, blooming heck. Or, you know what I mean? Whether you are the victim of someone in your family who's going through an addiction, where you are that person with an addiction, whether you're a person who's come the other side of the addiction, you're sitting there going, you too. And I believe allowing ourselves to realise we are not the only ones makes the battle that little bit easier.
100%. It's like you say, that like-minded individuals. When you know somebody's been through those, like you say, you too, you know, you've been through that too. You know what it feels like. And also it's very, everybody's situation is very different, isn't it? Like your mental health might be very different to how my mental health works out. And we have to understand that but a lot of the times what I try to do when I'm talking about mental health is I try to find what are our similarities, Kev, not what are our differences.
Yeah.
Let's see where we can connect, not where we don't connect. Mm. Because on the bits that we don't connect, we can learn about each other. Mm. But on the bits that we do understand and we've been through the same things, that's how we can grow. Yes. Do you know what I mean? And we can support each other. So I think there's two different things. I mean, I never used to. I mean, when I met a couple of weeks ago, I met with an old colleague of mine who I worked with at TalkSport. I hadn't seen him for 10 years since I left. And we were quite close. We worked together really closely. I mean, I went to his wedding, you know, so we were quite close. But we hadn't seen each other in all this time. And I said to him, but we didn't talk about these things even then 10 years ago. We weren't having these conversations. He was like, he sent me a message saying, you know, I'm sorry I wasn't there for you when you needed me. And I went, you've got no need to apologize. We didn't talk about them things then. You know, I should have come, I could have gone to them. You know, I mean, what my friend John said to me once, Matt, why did you never come to talk to me? And I went, I didn't think that's what you were there for. I didn't think that's what my friends were there for, to like phone up and talk. I thought they were like just to go to the pub with or just to, do you know what I mean? Not like, not to talk to.
But our experience with mental health is pretty similar, isn't it, Kev? Whereas I've known Kev pretty much all our lives, haven't we? You know, for a very long time now. But it's only really, the last 3-4 years that we've opened up to each other about our mental health. And you just think, you look back now and go, my God, my life would have been so much easier if I'd have talked before. Yeah. But you're scared of being ridiculed. You're scared of a lot of things in opening up. But I'll tell everyone out there now, you feel so much better once you start talking about it and finding someone, again, who's been through lived experience, like Kev. The first thing when me and Kev started talking is we realised very, very, very quickly that we go through the same things, we go through the same emotions. It might be a different cause for those emotions, but we go through the same things. We both suffered with anxiety, panic attacks, depression, and we both hid it from each other for years. And you just think, say everyone out there listening now, speak up sooner. There's no need to suffer.
No, there isn't any need to suffer. Particularly, you know, and it's in our heads, we make it a big deal, don't we, about speaking about it. In our heads, we think, oh, no, I can't say that. I can't say that because what would they think of me? But if you go to the right places, I can tell you 100% you're going to come out of there feeling better. You're going to come out of there feeling like a weight is being lifted off your shoulder. And it's not to say you should just go out to anybody and start talking about your mental health. You've got to go to the right places, haven't you?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's where you go wrong. You don't just bump into someone in the supermarket and go, oh, by the way, I'm having a wobble. Thinking, who the hell are you? I've only come to some bread, piss off.
No, you don't. And you've got to choose. And even still now with my recovery, there's certain people that I'll talk to certain things about, and there's other people that I'll talk to other things about. I love them all the same, but there's people I feel more comfortable with sitting about that situation than I do with, you know, somebody else. So I've learned that I have to be a little bit protective about what I say to certain people as well, because I know how they might react.
But that's clever, isn't it? You don't necessarily give everyone everything. No. You know what I mean? There's a very, very, very select few people who I do give everything to. And I say you've got to put people in pots, you know, people you lend money to, people you lend money off, people who would, you'd have a cry around, people you go to the pub, people you watch a movie. And it's very, very, very few people that they all come into that one pot.
Mm.
So don't expect everyone to be able to do everything, because you'll always be disappointed.
No, you're absolutely right. And I think the other thing is I had to take some time out. So when I left rehab, I was like, what am I going to do now? Because you've been somewhere. I mean, let me just tell you, and I don't know you guys, if you have any experience or you know anybody who's been to rehab, but it's not all white fluffy towels and bathrobes and spas and, you know, like in my mind before I went, it's like, it's in Bournemouth, it's by the sea. Maybe it's going to be like, you know, one of these like nice hotels.
You get pampered for the next 6 months.
it's part of a hotel and I'm going to have like a sauna every day. And no, it's not like that. It's like going back to school. So we stayed in houses which were comfortable and safe, and I felt supported. And you stay with other people who are in the rehab too. You sit down, you eat together every evening, you cook your own meals, and you are responsible for yourself. And then every day you go off to the treatment center and you do a day of learning about yourself. And that's it, pretty much. I mean, it's not quite that simple. It's a lot harder work. You have to put a lot of work in and a lot of effort in. But when you come out, that's when the work starts, because it's like, wow, I'm back in the real world. So I had to really get back on my feet. I had nothing. Like, literally, I had nothing. So I managed to, thankfully, somebody helped me with the deposit for the flat. My friend John, who I keep mentioning, like, sent me some money and said, buy some stuff for the flat to get. I mean, you know, what a wonderful guy. I mean, you know, just, and, you know, and then people chipped in and I managed to start to build my life a little bit. And then I thought, well, what do I want to do? Because I was just like not doing much, you know. And I started doing like jobs, just, you know, jobs I'd never done before. Like I worked on the market for a while with a friend of mine, you know, selling flowers. I worked in like removals for a while just so I could pay my rent, you know, start getting some money back in again, because I had nothing, you know, literally zero. I had to start building relationships. So I contacted my mum. I started to see my mum again. I started to talk to her. I started to build relationships with some of my friends again. Not all of them, because some of them were only drinking friends.
Mm, yeah.
They don't want to know you when you're not drinking anymore.
Yeah.
Simple fact. And they can't see past what had gone on. So if you had behaved in a certain way while you were drinking, I mean, I was never a violent drinker or anything like that. I would just get very tired and just black out, but just fall asleep, basically. You know, I was just very quiet. But some people, they just can't forgive or they can't move on from that. So you have to just choose carefully who you really want to keep close to you on your recovery journey as well. So I had to build my life back up. So I was doing some removals. Then I went and worked in a bed shop for like a few years. And I was like, oh, what am I going to do? Like, you know, because you then,
your self-esteem starts coming back, but at the same time you feel a bit stuck because you think, well, where am I going to go? Like, I've been out of the industry for so long. I've like been out of the media industry for 3 or 4 years. Once you're out for that amount of time, and also burnt quite a few bridges because of like what had gone on for me, how do you get back in? And I actually went for a job interview at Chelsea Football Club, and the interview went really well, and they asked me to go back for a second interview, but it was in London, and I didn't want to move back to London. I made my home here because I'd never felt like I had a home before, because I was traveling a lot for work and I didn't really have any friends in London, and I'd built up this like life in Bournemouth, you know. So I actually like say, I don't think this is for me. I'm sorry. And they were really good about my time out the industry as well, because I spoke to them about that. And they said, we'd rather have somebody come who's dealt with their problems than somebody here who's currently got problems. Do you know what I mean? That you'd actually taken care of yourself and taken time to go and sort it out. So they were really good about that, to be fair to them. But it just wasn't for me. So then I was thinking, what am I going to do? And then coming back to, well, I've got lived experience of gambling, so that's what I'm going to look into. And, eventually just over a year ago, ended up with Bet No More, which, by the way, has been brilliant. You know, Matt, who runs Peer Aid, there's lots of Matts at Bet No More, by the way. There's three of them. It's a little bit confusing. But Matt, who I work with, you know, Matt is fantastic. You know, and Frankie, our CEO, he's a really great guy. These guys have got lived experience as well, you know, so we all support each other at the same time.
Could you tell us some more about it, please, Bet No More? Could you tell us how to find it and just what to expect when you found it?
Yep, so you got betnomoreuk.org, which you guys have got, I can see it coming across the screen here, which is fabulous. So that looks great. We've got our Twitter. So Twitter is at betnomore. So betnomore, and the no is K-N-O-W, as in knowledge. So betnomore, all one word. And you can just go on our website, have a look at the services that we do. And you know, there's phone numbers on there, there's ways of contacting us, and you know, we will help where we can. It's a great organization. I mean, literally, you know, I'm a firm believer that the way that any charity or a business operates, you know, comes from the top. And it's a bit difficult saying this, because when I first started at TalkSport, I had a fantastic boss whose name was Bill Ridley. Bill worked in the newspaper industry for a long time. He was a Fleet Street hack. He was really, really good guy. He then went and worked in the States for a while. And he gave me my break, you know. He gave me my break, and, you know, he retired, and I think he's living out his retirement in Spain these days. But what happened when I came to Bet No More and I started working with Matt, and then working more now with Frankie as well, I felt at home, because I felt like Frankie's leadership style is very similar to Bill's, and me and Bill got on brilliantly, and he was so important to me. I mean, I'm just going to say quickly, when it all came out about my gambling, Bill had been retired for a few years, but he found out that I was staying with Ronnie, and he rang Ronnie's house to speak to me. That was the type of man he was. Do you know what I mean? He rang me and he said he didn't judge. He didn't. He just picked up the phone. He said, "How are you, Sport?" He used to call me Sport, which is ironic considering I work for TalkSport. He used to call me Sport, and he used to say, "How are you, Sport?" And that's what he did. You know, and he rang me, and that made me feel good again, you know, for that brief period of time. So then when working at Bet, I felt that, like, we've got this kind of open door policy. I mean, we have stuff like, we have health and wellbeing meetings where all of us get together once a month and we talk about how we're doing, how we're feeling, what's going on for us, no holds barred. Mm. I mean, what like a progressive company does that? Do you know what I mean? That's like, we're all there, you know. I mean, Frankie doesn't take part in that because he's the CEO and he lets us do that. Do you know what I mean? You know, we get time. He always says to us, work-life balance. You know, we work from home, we get very generous holiday, we are responsible for ourselves in our own work. And I think that leadership that comes from the top means that we give so much back. And I said to Frankie recently, this is somewhere I want to continue to work. This is somewhere, I mean, I'm telling you this because please see it as a good thing that I'm saying to you. I want to stay and work here long term. Because you don't often get an employee go to their employer and say, this is where I want to be.
Yeah, I think at the moment as well, within regards to there's a lot of companies out there now who are promoting their mental health and mental health within their companies, but they're doing it to kind of tick that box.
Yeah.
Whereas what he showed straight away is he's not doing it to tick the box. He's doing it because he genuinely cares about the mental health of his staff by doing those days, by not being involved himself as well, because ultimately you're less likely to open up, whether you get on with your boss or not, you're less likely to open up with your boss sitting next to you than if he's not in that room, you know.
And I would
feel, you've got a grievance with him, it'd be more like, well, if he knows what's going on in my mind, is he going to sack me, you know? Yeah. So I think it's fantastic.
I would feel absolutely confident and feel absolutely at ease to pick up the phone to any of my colleagues and tell them how I'm feeling right now. How many organisations can you say that they'd be okay with that? Not many.
I could honestly say I've never, ever worked for a company where I felt I could do that, ever.
I know. That's incredible. Like, where I can eat up to the top. I mean, I'm saying I could phone Frankie and say, Frankie, this is how I feel right now about this. And we'd be able to have an open and honest conversation and you feel supported and cared for. I mean, you know, I told you I'd just been on holiday and my flight was delayed by a day. So I told the guys, flight's been delayed by a day. I'm thinking I might like to stay for an extra day on my holiday. No problem. Do what you like. No, you've got to get back. You know what I mean? You have your holiday. And that's like, if you give me that, I am going to give you 150%. When I'm working for you, you're getting 150% out of me because the way you treat me. So, you know, for me, I never thought that I could, once I left TalkSport, I never thought that I was going to have a job that I enjoyed again. I never thought that was going to happen, you know, because I was already in that brilliant job, you know, and working with some brilliantly talented, creative and fantastic people. But I found it again. Do you know what I mean? So I know when I'm onto a good thing, and that's why I want to stay. So I'm hoping they'll keep me for a bit longer.
And there's a lot of people who can learn from what you've explained there. There's a lot of companies out there that can learn from that and realize that actually you treat the employees right and they will work harder for you. You will get more out of them in that long run.
You know what you said as well? Earlier you said something, Lee, which has just completely slipped out of my mind, but it was probably about integrity in a way that we talk about leadership, and in this sector, you know, you get a lot of lived experience people. And what I've noticed with Bet No More, which is fantastic, is the people who have lived experience, and we say that lived experience is running through the heart of the charity and the business side. It's what we do. We use our lived experience to run our programs. But it's not, that's what you said. You said about those things being token gestures, you know, like they're just doing it to say they've done it. We don't do that. Like, there's people in our senior management team who have lived experience of gambling. You're not just giving the people who have lived experience the lower level jobs. You're putting them into the senior management team. Because it's quite easy, isn't it, to say, actually, you know what? Yeah, we'll box it off, and the people with lived experience go down a bit lower because we don't, you know, that's just how it works sometimes. They don't do that here. If you can do a job, you're going up there. And I think that's like, that is basically saying, we're saying that lived experience runs through the heart of what we do, and we're doing it as well.
That's fantastic. And you'll get more out of what you're doing, won't you? Or the the people who you're helping will get more out of with that, because ultimately the change comes from the top. So if you've got that lived experience and you can see, actually, we could do this a bit different. This is from my personal experience. I went through this. This is how it helped. This is what I did to help me. You can move that down from the top then to the people who are helping the, you know, helping down there. Whereas if you're not aware of it, how are you going to help them? We speak about it quite often with disability. I have a daughter who's got a severe disability, and obviously Kev with his eyes, his disability. And we find that a lot of, when we're speaking to MPs and politicians and people like that, they'll have disability people on the board with this disability. None of them are disabled, but they're making decisions on behalf of people with disability. You're thinking, how do you know? How do you know that's going to work? Why don't you get people who experience it day in, day out? Because they know what works. They have to go there. So Kev's mentioned it before, things like putting yellow lines on stairs. No, I wouldn't know that. I'm not blind. Kev knows it because he's blind. So speak to him and put him in a position where he can make changes.
Well, exactly. Like, Kev, you've got that experience. You need to be at the top making them decisions, not at the bottom.
Yeah.
Oh, I've always said I deserve to be on the top.
Of course you do, mate. Honestly, this is what makes, you know, you've got somebody with that experience. Why would you have them at the bottom?
And it's the same with mental health, same with addictions. We need the people who know how it feels to be on both sides of the tracks.
Yes, 100%, you know. And also, I think the other thing is working for a charity, as I said earlier, we have people who have come from all different walks of life. And you guys said it earlier, alcoholics, drug addicts, gambling, whatever it is. This is a great story. When I went to treatment, I went to my doctor. Now, I had this image, as a lot of people do, of alcoholics drinking out of a brown paper bag, a bottle of vodka, in the corner of a street down an alleyway. That's the image that's shown to us through the media of how it looks, isn't it?
Yeah.
I went to the doctors because I had to go to do a kind of a bit of a medical when I arrived at treatment. So I sat with the doctor and told the doctor, he said, what are you here for? And I said, I'm here for alcohol and gambling. And he said, I understand. And I looked at him like, well, do you? You know, and he said, I'm 25 years sober.
Yeah.
And it changed my perception within seconds, because I thought, this is a guy who's a doctor. Mm-hmm. So he's in a profession which he's considered to be in high regard. Mm-hmm. You look at a doctor and you think, you know what? That's a good job, isn't it? And you look after people and you care for people and you probably have quite a good life out of it. And it shifted my mindset completely into what addiction looks like. And if you guys said that right at the beginning, it can affect anybody at any time. So when he said that to me, I was like, right. And I've met so many people now in my recovery life from so many different walks of life. I can't begin to tell you. I mean, sports people, we're here. How many sports people do we hear now coming out with stories of mental health issues? You know, alcohol, gambling, everything.
Well, that's it. It doesn't matter if you're in a cardboard box or a 10-bedroom mansion. If you've got those devil, that demon in your head, he'll find you. But Matt, what I'd love to do is I'd love to invite you back on one of the days, and we'll go down, like, because we've talked mainly about the gambling today. But when you're free next, get you back on and talk about the alcohol side and the sporting side, and say, because something I will say on the next episode, like hitting your goal at 25 and being over abroad, it's very easy to get down the rabbit hole of alcoholism. So I'd love to explore that another show, if you would.
Oh, more than happy to. I'd love to come back and talk to you guys. I've really enjoyed it.
But we've been on for an hour and a half, and I know you've had your
past my bedtime,
and I know you're jet lagged and all. So once again, it'd be wonderful, wouldn't it, to get back
definitely.
On?
Definitely, really enjoyed the show tonight. Thank you very much, Matt.
But I always like to end the show on: have you got any quotes or sayings that have helped you get through life?
The one thing, I suppose, and it's talked about quite a lot in the recovery world, and I know anybody who's listening who's in recovery themselves may well have heard it, but it's the Albert Einstein quote, and it's around the definition of insanity.
and it's repeating the same behavior again and again and expecting a different outcome. And that really resonates with me today, because my behavior was the same every single day. And that's what made me start to go pretty much insane. And, you know, my thinking was very warped. And now on my day-to-day life, I use that. When I'm thinking the same way and I'm not getting anywhere, I change my thinking to a different way, and then I start to get somewhere. And so when I'm feeling, for example, when I'm stuck in my own head and I'm starting to get a little bit selfish, I go out and I go and do something for somebody else, or I pick up the phone and ask them how they are. I change the way my brain works. A friend of mine, Jeff, says to me, Jeff's a long time in recovery. I must say he's over 20 years sober, I think, now. And Jeff says to me, if you wake up feeling one day you're a bear with a sore head. I said that to him one day. I said, I feel it today. You know, I'm not really in a good mood today. But it's okay, because tomorrow I'll wake up and I'll start again. And he said, why are you waiting till tomorrow? It's within our power to change how we feel. So that's why when he said that to me, I was like, yeah, you're right. And he started that conversation, and then I started to feel better. So, yeah.
Well, that's wonderful, brother. I hope everyone's enjoyed it, because I know I have. So, guys, until we see each other next time, take care of yourselves and each other. Ta-ra a bit.
Listen.
And that's a wrap for another show. But if there are any comments or messages that you'd like us to read out for our next podcast, please be in touch. There are also lots of different organisations at the bottom of this page, and hopefully they can help you or someone you care about. Please share this to spread the word. Until we talk next time, ta-ra a bit.
Listen.
Mate.
You're right, bruv.